This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Yesterday, President Obama and China's President Xi Jinping announced that both countries, the world's biggest polluters, will sign the Paris Agreement on climate change. They'll sign that on Earth Day, April 22nd. Good timing, because a study out this week suggests a melting Antarctica could pump up global sea levels a lot more than we thought, contributing to an overall rise of 5 to 6 feet by the end of the century. Think your grandchildren. And if they're right, that nearly doubles the more conservative estimates of sea level rise put out by the IPCC. My next guest is an ice analyst by trade who spent 3 seasons in both Antarctica and Alaska and 8 in Greenland. And he's here to weigh in on that all-important phase transition from ice to water. Richard Alley is professor of geosciences at Penn State University. And by the way, he was not involved in this week's study, but he has collaborated with the authors in the past. He joins us from WQED in Pittsburgh. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira. It's my pleasure.
It's nice to have you. What does this new study add to the discussion on sea level rise that we didn't know before?
Right. So we've known for a long time that if you make it too warm, ice melts. And we've been warming it, and ice has been melting, but so far it's been slow. The rate at which the big ice sheets of Greenland and Antarctica have been shrinking, it would have taken them 100,000 years to go away. That's the equivalent of me going on a diet for a year and losing a third of a potato chip. Our worry is that I could use a faster diet. Our worry is that we don't want them on a faster diet, but they could. They could lose weight a lot faster. And this new study has put some new physics into the model that we know could happen and ask what those real physical processes might mean for the future. And it's not optimistic.
And can you give us an idea of what the change is, what the model difference is?
Right. So what we have seen is that when the ice is a big pile that spreads under its own weight, it flows down to the coast and it makes these floating extensions called ice shelves. The ice shelves are in fjords and they scrape past the side, and that friction holds the shelf back, which holds the pile back, and it keeps sea level low and the ice high. When we make it warm, we break off those ice shelves, and it leaves a big cliff of the kind that you might see in front of a beautiful calving glacier in Alaska. And if that cliff is too high, it breaks, and it may break rapidly. Right now, the biggest of those cliffs are sort of 30 stories above sea level and almost 10 times that below sea level. But there's a piece of West Antarctica that could make a much bigger cliff. And bigger cliffs are prone to breaking more rapidly. And when they put in bigger cliffs break faster into the model, a sufficiently large warming makes a big, fast sea level rise.
Wow. So it's actually the rate that it's occurring that we're talking about.
It is indeed the rate.
It's going to happen faster than we thought.
That's the concern if we keep warming it. Now, in this new study, if we slow the warming, the ice sheet might not lose its ice shelf, and it might stabilize at a place that it has a small enough cliff that all heck doesn't break loose. But in a really rapidly warming future, by late in this century, you get rid of the ice shelf, you get the high cliff, and you get really fast sea level rise.
What's amazing to think about this is something that, you know, is in the lifetime of our families, right? This could be your grandchildren on the coastline someplace. What the figure was, millions of people would be involved here?
That's my understanding, is that yes, when we start looking at 3 feet, 6 feet or more, there's a lot of people close to that. And
yeah,
you start thinking about, what did Hurricane Sandy do to the subways in New York? And a rise that would be close to the size of what was going into those subways all by itself without help from a storm.
Okay, so that's Antarctica. I've heard that if the entire Greenland ice sheet melted, the whole thing, that sea levels would actually be lower around Greenland. Is that possible?
Very close to it. So there's an interesting nuance here. As you know, all bodies are gravitationally attracted to all other bodies. You and I are attracted very, very weakly because we're small and far apart. But Greenland's ice, or Antarctica's ice, is so big that it actually attracts the ocean to it. And so if you melt a body of ice, the sea level rises on average everywhere, but that ice, the water that was pulled to the ice sheet relaxes away. So in Antarctica, for example, if you melted West Antarctica's ice, it raises the global average sea level about 11 feet. Right next to the Antarctic ice, sea level will actually fall. And in Washington, D.C., sea level will go up about 13 or 14 feet.
13 or 14 feet in, would that be New York, too?
Yes.
The whole East Coast there?
The Northern Hemisphere gets more than the average, the Southern Hemisphere less from Antarctica, and vice versa for Greenland.
You know, climatologist Jim Hansen has been very outspoken about this for a number of years. This sort of backs up what he's been saying, does it not? Validates his position?
I think it is fair to say Jim has been ahead of us very often, and he has raised a lot of warnings about the possibility of rapid sea level rise. And this is putting some physics behind the things that he's been thinking about.
You know, you have said, I've seen videos on YouTube of you said in the past that you were a Republican, but one who obviously contributes to our understanding of global climate change. And you are puzzled by why global warming has been a political hot potato.
It flabbergasts me some days. The first time I testified to a subcommittee of the U.S. Senate, it was chaired by a Republican who wanted to put in place the sort of price signal conservative solution that would move us forward and improve the economy as well as the environment.
And so what happened? Do you have any idea what happened? Why the... It became political. You know, people like to blame Al Gore for this because he was a polarizing, quote unquote, figure. Do you buy that?
It is possible that the blame rests with me, with us as scientists, at some level. That rather than us stepping up and doing the job of teaching what we know, that we waited for someone like Mr. Gore to do the job, and that because he comes from one side, that did put some people off. I could tell you a lot of stories of why. What I do know is that the science is very, very strong. And in addition, the evidence is very strong that if we take what we know and what we believe in and where we want to go, not only do we clean the environment, but we improve the economy.
Do you are you surprised that this is not an issue, knowing what you know and how, and the time that we know is almost around the corner, you know, in times of less than a century, that it's not a political issue in the campaigns this year?
My suspicion is that the attention span has gotten so short for people in a different piece of the media than your show, that this one doesn't make a good soundbite, and that I fear that many of the discussions have been reduced to things that would not be. Your show does things much better than that.
Thank you. We try. Sometimes it's not really hard to do that, unfortunately. Let's talk about ice sheets, because I'm very fascinated by ice. I was in Antarctica many, many years ago back in 1979, and I saw a lot of ice down there. What would you really want to know about ice that's still a mystery to scientists like yourself? Because ice is sort of a magical item, isn't it? It behaves like rock sometimes, behaves like liquid water.
Oh, yeah. And there's a huge amount that I want to know because it's fun and it's fascinating and it's interesting. And then there's a huge amount that I want to know because we actually owe it to the public to tell them how likely this is and how fast. And sometimes those overlap. Right now, the big issues include if you go in a ship, when you were in Antarctica, you either flew over or you came in on a ship. And if you'd looked down at the seafloor under you, you would have seen giant piles of mud that were left over thousands of years when the ice ended at one place. And then nothing. And the ice would have backed up way fast in a big hurry and then stopped somewhere else. The ice is like the military holding the high ground and then retreating off the valley to the next high ground. And right now, the ice we're most worried about is hanging on to a piece of high ground by its fingernails. And we would love to know exactly what's needed to keep it there or what might push it off.
Because as you were intimating before, there's sort of a wall that's keeping the main sheets of ice from going into the ocean. And if we lose that, that would slide right in.
That's right. There's a lot of this has in it thresholds. You push it a little bit and not much happens. You push it a little more and you cross the threshold and something huge happens. Mm-hmm. And a lot of this has in it breaking things. And breaking things, you can do the experiment in your head. Imagine a room full of people with ceramic coffee cups on a hard floor. And on three, everyone in the room tosses a ceramic coffee cup up in the air and they fall on the floor. And what happens? That one breaks and that one chips and that one bounces and that one cracks and that one blows into smithereens. Predicting when things will break and how they will break is hard. And we're trying to predict one coffee cup.
Would it be fair to say that Greenland is sort of the Antarctic of the North? Basically very similar in ice?
There's a lot of similarities there. We are cautiously optimistic that most of Greenland can't fall in the ocean as rapidly as pieces of West Antarctica can. When these giant lakes break through the ice and make the huge floods and the drama, there's bumps underneath. It's like Greenland is spreading across a waffle iron and it can't fall off very easily. Pieces of Antarctica are more like spreading across a greased griddle rather than a waffle iron.
Mm. And so going to both places, you learn a little bit more about the waffle iron and the griddle.
Absolutely. And we really do need both places because there's things going on in Greenland now, which is a little warmer, that may be the future of Antarctica. And we can see what's happening in Greenland and translate that into what might happen in Antarctica.
That's pretty scary, Dr. Allen, I'll tell you. It's pretty scary.
But there is some optimism there. We still might win this one.
All right. Well, I'm going to take your optimistic route, okay? Richard Alley is a professor of geosciences at Penn State University, and he teaches listening now how to bring climate science into the classroom. We have a team of experts together for a live online panel next Tuesday, April 5th, at sciencefriday.com/climateclassroom. Tuesday, April 5th, RSVP sciencefriday.com/climateclassroom. Get your classroom involved. We'll be right back after this break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. This week, Instagram announced a proposed change to its photo feed. The photo sharing app is going to ditch the chronological ordering of photos, you know, send them as they come in, and they're going to turn to an algorithmic filter. We're going to talk about what that means because Instagram has not made the changes yet. And already, users are up in arms. There was an immediate call to arms on social media. A change.org petition was put out, which now sits at over 300,000 signees. And the hashtag #KeepInstagramChronological has started trending. So what is an algorithmic filter? Why the outcry? How are posts being sorted across platforms? How does this determine what we see online? Lots of questions we're going to try to get to the answers with Will Arima, senior technology writer at Slate here in New York. Hillary Mason, founder and CEO of Fast Forward Labs, also in New York. They're in our CUNY studios here. Welcome. Good to see you both again.
Great to see you too.
Thanks for having us.
And we have our number to call for folks who want to talk about it. Our number is 844-724-8255, 844-SciTalk. You can also tweet us at SciFry. I would like to know, do you like a certain type of feed for specific purposes? A chronological feed for keeping up with sports? You want that. Or does an unfiltered dump of posts feel overwhelming to you? Will, you're gritting your teeth almost about this. What's going on here? What's the difference? Why do this?
Well, it's so interesting. Every time people hear about their favorite social media service changing how it shows them the posts in their feed, they get so upset. I mean, it shows you, doesn't it, how personally we take this and how important it is to us, really, whether it's Facebook or Instagram.
Yeah.
Twitter had a similar backlash recently when it announced that it would start using some algorithmic filtering in its feed. But, you know, the funny thing is that as much as we hate the idea of this, the massive success of Facebook, which is really the sort of prime example of a social media feed that is ordered by a complex algorithm, shows us that it works. I mean, people keep coming back to Facebook. We say we don't like Facebook making these choices for us, and yet we use it every day.
Hillary, what does this term algorithm mean? How does that show up differently than what's happening now?
So an algorithm is really just a recipe. In this case, it's a mathematical way of processing the data. And what they're doing here is actually not that complicated. They're looking at the things that cause you to engage more, to like photos, to spend more time looking at them. They're using that to train a system that will predict which photos in your feed you're going to like the most, and then they're going to show you that set of photos rather than just the chronological set of photos you would have seen otherwise.
Mm-hmm. The fact that Instagram was bought by Facebook, and, you know, is Facebook trying to make it more look like Facebook?
Well, I can't speak for Facebook's intent, but I do know that both Instagram and Facebook have wonderful teams of machine learning engineers, and they have strong incentives to keep us all engaged with looking and clicking and liking those photos.
Mm-hmm. Well, is this all about money? I mean, everything on the this game is getting more clicks or advertising, things like that.
Yeah, it is and it isn't all about money. I mean, it's all about money in the sense that Facebook is a public company. It's trying to, it's trying to keep making money hand over fist, as it's been doing with extraordinary success for the past few years. But it's a little too simple to say that a change like this is just about maximizing revenue in the short term, because a company like Facebook, especially where Mark Zuckerberg actually controls a majority of the voting shares, mm-hmm. they're looking at the long game. And so, yes, they care about making money. They think that sorting your feed according to what they call a relevancy score, that's the output of this machine learning algorithm they have, sorting your feed according to how relevant each post might be to you helps them to maximize revenue in various ways. But most importantly, what they're always looking at is, does it keep you happy with Facebook? Does it keep you coming back? And they're going to want to know the same thing about Instagram. They're going to be studying it. From my experience with Facebook, they're going to be studying it from 25 different angles. What are all the effects of these changes to the algorithm? And are they making people happy or are they making people unhappy? And then thus Instagram would lose money in the long term by turning people off.
But 300,000 signatures on a petition sounds like, to me, Hillary, like unhappy at this point.
So it's particularly interesting because the tension here, I think, is not so much that people are resistant to algorithms. These are similar to the algorithms they already use to target ads at you, for example, on all of these platforms. And we don't hear people really complaining about that every day. What's different here, though, is that this algorithm is now mediating a social action. So it's sitting between me and you and our friendship, and it's deciding, you know, sort of what part of that friendship I'm going to see and you're going to see. And I think that's where the tension comes from. It's not from the mathematics. It's from the social interruption.
If it was a real person doing it, do you think it would be different? People would have a different reaction. The fact that they're being processed by some algorithm. You know, I'm a person.
Yeah. And I think that if there were actually a human being at Instagram HQ sitting there deciding, oh, is this a good enough picture to put in Hillary's feed? I would be probably more annoyed. I think people are less consistent than algorithms.
Yeah, go ahead, Will.
What's interesting, though, is that actually, so Facebook's algorithm is only as good as the data that goes in. That's why it's always studying your behavior on the site. It's looking at what you click on, what you like, what you share. Over time, it's been looking at more and more advanced metrics, like when you click on a post in your feed, how long do you spend reading that post on a different website before you come back? And do you hit like on it before or after you've read it? Because if you hit like before you've read it, maybe it was just clickbait. You know, maybe it wasn't actually that great of a story. And one of the things they've turned to recently is actually a more personalized form of data. They have now hired thousands of people around the world to go through their Facebook feed every day and say which stories they actually would like to see at the top of their feed. They rate everything they see and give that sort of human feedback that Facebook thinks maybe this is the kind of data that will make people feel better about having an algorithm make those choices for them.
We took a poll of our Twitter followers, and the first 2,000 people who voted, we got them in, and we found that 92% prefer a chronological timeline. Only 8% wanted algorithmic filtered feed. Not surprising.
Right? It's not that surprising, again, because people want to be in some sense of have a sense of control over what they see in their social network. And I think one thing we've glossed over here is that the algorithm is not transparent. It is, by definition, a black box. And, you know, if they told us what was going on, we'd exploit it. So they can't do that. And we can worry about what biases the creators of that algorithm, the people doing the feature engineering, might have. Like, think about what if, Facebook machine learning engineer really likes dogs and really hates cats, and that gets built into the algorithm.
Mm.
Is that a world we're happy with? It's very unlikely, but still, these are questions that are reasonable to ask because we don't know what's happening under the hood.
We have some tweets coming in about with people reacting to it. Christine Rogers says, chronologically, I want it so I can follow breaking news. I use a hashtag for relevance. Nolinger says, a good algorithm that I can tweak. Please, what happened to the tailorable interfaces and transparent personalization? Maybe is there a middle ground that you can flip a switch and say, I'll take it either way, choose which way you want it to have it curated?
You know, Twitter has really been trying to find that middle ground. Facebook hasn't. Facebook's all the way on one side. They're all about the algorithm. It works for them. They're going to stick with that. Also, I should note, Facebook doesn't really care that much at this point about following along with events in real time. That has always been Twitter's game. Its edge is that because the feed is chronological, you can have an ongoing conversation. You can discuss what you're watching on TV right at that moment. Twitter's never going to get rid of that entirely, I don't think. And if they do, I think it will doom the company. So they've been looking for a middle ground where they show you some algorithmically selected tweets at the top of your feed, and then they put the rest of the tweets in chronological order. They've tried the things that some of your tweeters talked about. They've tried, you know, giving people options. Facebook has tried giving people control over their feeds. People don't do it. By and large, people say they want it. They actually don't use that control when it's given to them, and they don't toggle between an algorithmic feed and a chronological feed, and that's why Twitter is trying to do it all in a single feed.
Is this an effort to take on Twitter at all? Do you see this as a competition?
Yeah, is it an effort to take on Twitter? I mean, I think Twitter feels like it's getting crushed by Facebook, and that, I think that is why Twitter has been looking at more ways to surface the tweets at the top of your feed that it thinks will appeal to you. It sees how well that has worked for Facebook. Twitter is in a real bind because when it went public a few years ago, the idea was that it was the next Facebook. And so all its investors were counting on it to get that big. Well, it turns out that about 20% of American adults love Twitter and its chronological timeline. And the other 80%, meh, they don't really care that much. And Twitter has to find a way to capture some of that other 80% that Facebook has really managed to compel with its algorithmic feed.
And its stock has taken a real beating since then, hasn't it? Hillary, how predictive can these algorithms become in the future?
So one of the really common misconceptions about this sort of machine learning is that it can perfectly model your individual behavior as a unique human being into the future. And that's really not the case. These things tend to be quite accurate at the population level or when doing an aggregate analysis. But that doesn't mean that it can say that you specifically are going to engage, just that you may be more likely because you're part of this population. And so this is really not something you need to worry about in terms of being able to say, you know, at precisely this time of day, you're going to click on that photo of a puppy or a baby, but rather that it may choose to bias the things that you see by what people like you actually do and how they behave.
Let me see if I can get a couple of phone calls in. Our number 844-724-8255. Let's go to Birmingham, Alabama. Tesla, is it?
It is Tesla, yes.
Very appropriate name.
And not a car, but...
Do you have lightning bolts going everywhere around you? Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. I just had a question in regards to something Will had said, you know, about Facebook users, you know, staying on and not, you know, leaving and stopping using Facebook because of the algorithm. And I just feel like if there was probably another option that was, you know, up to par with Facebook, I'm not sure that that would be maybe accurate. And even with Instagram, like, there's not anything that's really like Instagram. So, of course, we're staying because we love these sites and services, but we still don't like the way that it's happening. And as far as, you know, toggling between chronological and sometimes when you go to your most recent, you know, it can be, you'll see a post that says 8 hours ago, and then, you know, on top, and then five posts down, it says 2 minutes. So it's not even really, you know, in order. I just kind of felt, you know, his comment's probably accurate, but if there was something, if there were other options, I'm not sure that we would all, you know, still be using these services.
All right. Good point. Will, you want to comment?
Yeah, I think your caller is absolutely right that there is genuine anger and genuine resentment among users of these services when these changes happen. They don't like the fact that some engineers in Silicon Valley are deciding for them which friends' posts they see at any given time. That said, you know, Facebook has huge teams of data analysts who are looking all the time at this immense array of metrics. And every time it changes anything in the algorithm, it's going to look at 15 different ways that that's affecting people's engagement. And what the data in aggregate tells Facebook again and again is that if you use the right data and you tweak the algorithm in the right way, that it will keep people coming back. That doesn't mean that some people might not be turned off. It doesn't mean that people might be using the service and be unhappy about it. But that's actually something that Facebook's been working on as well, which is that they are now directly asking more and more users, are you happy with Facebook? Did this post make you happy or did it make you upset? And they are trying to address that real problem, I think.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Here in New York, talking with Hillary Mason and Will Arimus. Well, we have a question from Twitter. MJ Mahometa tweets, maybe we should ask, can we come up with an algorithm that best represents time? Is there an algorithm? Because you just heard what the caller said. I get one that says 8 hours ago after I get one that said 2 minutes ago.
I want to hear Hillary's thoughts on this, but I just want to point out, I mean, a chronological feed, there's still an algorithm there.
That is an algorithm.
It's an algorithm that is sorting all the possible tweets from the people you follow. It's only sorting them on one criterion, which is time. So,
right. And we might be able to add some other simple things into that. Like maybe we'd sort it by time and geography, or time and geography and that friend of mine who always posts 10 pictures of their food before they eat it. Let me only see one of those. One is sufficient. And these kinds of heuristics are algorithms themselves. But time itself is pretty straightforward.
Mm-hmm. And the drawback to doing it just by time is, and this is what Instagram said when it announced this change that has caused such a backlash. They said, look, you're missing on average 70% of the posts in your feed. Now, we can't change the fact that you're going to miss 70% of the posts. But what if we could come up with a way to make sure that the 30% you are seeing are the ones you care about more? What if it isn't just the most recent 30% that you want to see? What if there are some others that might be more important to you?
Yeah, because you're not going to see those posts. They go by so fast, right? So you're saying if we make an algorithm that you get to see the same people that you deal with all the time, maybe you'd like that better. Instead of just chronologically.
Yeah, it's a pretty compelling argument, the idea that you're going to see some 30% of the set of photos that exist in your feed, and why don't you see the best 30%? Why do you only see the 30% that happen to be there when you're paying attention?
Mm-hmm. Let me see if I can get one more call in from Gainesville, Florida. John, hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. The thing that struck me when I was listening actually is a different thing. We're worried about that interface, and I work in IT, and the interface is really important. People care a lot about it. But what really struck me is another feed that understands us. So my comment was really, we're getting to a place where we know more and more things. So I know they already hold the data, but now if you're going to have Instagram and other feeds, it's like another window. So who understands who I am? Some people know me really well. And where's that data being held? Where's that understanding of me and what I'm going to click on and what I'm going to like? And how is that used? It's privacy, but it's not just privacy. Now it's taking the level of marketing and advertising of the Mad Men to a very, very different place. And so there's a bigger question to me about the results of that algorithm, not just the fact that it's using it.
Okay, Hillary, you want to react to that?
Yeah, that's a super important point, specifically for people who build algorithmic systems. And keep in mind that these sorts of algorithms are not just in our social media feeds. These are the same algorithms that run our spam filters, your Netflix movie selections, your Amazon.com and other e-commerce product suggestions. And so there's quite a bit of information about what you are likely to do that exists out there in the hands of various commercial entities. That said, again, I'll repeat the point that it's not particularly accurate when modeling any individual. Much more accurate at the level of the population.
Big data.
Yeah, indeed. But this is a conversation that we do need to have about who owns that data and who owns that model.
We're going to have that many, many more times, hopefully with both of you. Will Arimus, senior technology writer at Slate. Hillary Mason, founder and CEO of Fast Forward Labs. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks, Ira.
Thank you.
When we come back, spring is in the air and underground, too. A soil scientist is here to tell us about the microbial perfume of spring. right after this. It's the microbiome of the soil. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. There are lots of ways of celebrating spring. Take a long stroll, stroll on the beach, watch March Madness, or put your nose to the ground. Yeah, in the deep, dark underworld of soil, microbes also celebrate springtime, and you can find them if you know what to look for, or I should say, if you know what to smell for. Noah Feerer is a microbial ecologist, associate professor at the University of Colorado in Boulder. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Thanks for having me on the show.
Do you actually smell the ground, Noah? You smell it?
Oh, it's a glorious smell.
You got to describe that better. What is it? Is it like roses? Is it like fresh cut flowers? Is it like breakfast? What does it smell like?
It's that smell of wet soil. That smell that most of us are probably familiar with, that smell of springtime, the smell of soil. And really what we're smelling in most cases is actually the product of microbial activity, these microscopic organisms that are essentially very active in the springtime and feeding. And it's that smell, only some of those compounds, which we can actually detect with our relatively crude sense of smell, that's what gives that sort of characteristic wet, earthy smell.
So the microbiome is hard at work down there under the soil in the spring.
Exactly. And the microbes are still active in the wintertime. So unlike us that use the wintertime as an opportunity to huddle inside with some hot chocolate, microbes are still active in the wintertime doing what they do, for example, degrading plant material. But as soon as spring arrives, everything sort of ramps up and the microbes become more active.
Mm-hmm. Now, soil microbes are famous for being a source of antibiotics. We know that people are always trying to find new antibiotics from the soil microbes. Would this time of the year be an especially good time to test the soil for these novel compounds?
Yeah, so exactly. So as spring arrives, you typically have more water, higher temperatures, and there's also more food available to those microbes. And a lot of that food is coming from plant roots. So although we may not see a lot of plant biomass above ground or plant leaves, the roots in soil, the plant roots, are already starting to release a lot of food or carbon compounds for the microbes to eat. And that can trigger some competition between microbes for these scarce resources. And part of that competition entails the production of antibiotics. So there are fungi and there's bacteria that will produce antibiotics to kill other bacteria. So it's kind of like Thanksgiving dinner with a highly competitive Thanksgiving dinner.
You need a boarding house reach for the microbiome bacteria down there. And it never struck me before that, you know, why are there antibiotics being made in the soil? Because the microbes are fighting each other. Wow.
Exactly, yeah. Microbes are tough, but it's also a difficult place to live. They're often limited resources, and those resources that are available, they're going to compete for them. So they'll produce compounds to kill their neighbors, for example.
You did a study of Central Park soil a few years ago. What did you learn from that?
Well, one of the big take-home messages from that study is we sampled soils from throughout Central Park. And we chose Central Park because it's a park that's visited by millions of people a year, fairly familiar. Yet when we start looking in the soils from Central Park, we find enormous amounts of microbial diversity. So thousands of different species of bacteria and fungi, as well as other microscopic organisms. And what was surprising is most of these organisms are undescribed. We know they're living in soil, but we don't know what they're doing. We don't have names for them. And I think that study just really emphasized how little we know about the diversity that's found in soil.
See, could some of that diversity be coming from the New Yorkers and all the tourists who come sit on the rocks in Central Park?
Potentially, but the organisms that we see in Central Park soils are actually pretty typical to what we see in soils from all over the world. So yeah, there are some bacteria and some other organisms that are going to be coming from the visitors to Central Park. Most of them are growing there and just inhabit the soil.
I know how difficult, it's very difficult to take the microbes, out of the soil and bring them into the laboratory to study, is it not? I mean, like 90% of them don't survive on their own in the laboratory.
Yeah, there's just this amazing number of bacteria and fungi and other microorganisms that we can we can use techniques like DNA sequencing and so forth to see that they're in soil, but it's very hard to isolate them and study them in the lab and figure out what they like to eat, what environmental conditions they like to grow under. So it's really terra incognita. There's really a lot of unknowns about what sort of organisms are in soil and what they're doing in soil and how they may play a role in, for example, soil fertility.
So what can we as a gardeners, and I'm an avid gardener, what can I do to the soil to help that microbiome in the soil this time of the year?
Well, I mean, the one thing is they are going to be more active. You know, they're getting more food available to them. You've got these higher temperatures. You've got a lot of moisture. And they're going to be doing what they do. They're going to be degrading plant material, some of it left over from the fall. They're going to be producing these antibiotics. They're going to be reproducing and growing.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, they're tough. Sometimes they'll just keep going along. They don't need a lot of help from us.
what attracts you? You sound like you know you have such a romance with the soil, and I don't blame you. I know that smell. I know the feel of getting your hands on the soil. When did you first understand and discover that you were a soil person?
Primarily just due to how little we know about soil. I mean, obviously soil is very important to growing crops, to our gardens, to our natural ecosystems, and even to our lawns, things that we don't think about the lawn soil very much. But we know surprisingly little about what organisms are in soil, how they're interacting with one another, how they may be responding to changes in precipitation or changes in temperature and things like that. So what's appealing to me is just how little we know about this environment that we literally walk on almost every day.
And how does the microbiome affect seeds that drop into the soil?
So that's what's interesting. So you mentioned, we were talking about this smell of soil, this mm-hmm. ambrosia to soil biologists. It's, in my opinion, it's better than the finest perfume or cologne, this smell of microbes that are active in soil producing all these different compounds. Well, we do know that some of those compounds can actually serve as an alarm clock to plants, and they can trigger, for example, germination of seeds. So, whether that's a direct or indirect action, these smells are doing more than just appealing to our own senses. They can also trigger plant responses, for example.
Is there any way to make it more healthy, or are there things that we do? I mean, to hurt the microbes in the soil. I remember we heard of a study a while back that actually plowing or tilling the field actually wrecks the microbiome that you don't want to do. It's better to just stick the seed in the soil.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of things we do to our soil, applying pesticides, tilling the soil, that can alter the types of organisms and disrupt some of the food webs in soil. So the key is really to supply that organic matter back into the soil, give the microbes food to eat, and try not to disturb them that much. But that question is a good one, is how do we actively start managing the organisms in soil to promote plant health, for example? And that's a question that's very much, people are really diving into that now and trying to figure out how can we start manipulating the organisms in soil to make that soil more fertile.
Is there any way, you said we know so little about all, you mentioned Central Park and there's so many microbes in there that we've never seen before. Is there any way to catalog any of these unknown microbes?
So there's lots of efforts underway right now to catalog the diversity of organisms in soil, and not only the microbes, not only the bacteria and fungi, but also the nematodes, these minuscule worms, the insects and other arthropods and so forth. And a lot of that surveying is being done using DNA sequencing technologies that allow us to get a glimpse of at least who's there. And that's really the first step, is start seeing what types of organisms do we find in soil and how do those types change across different soil types or different management strategies and stuff like
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm. There are lots of ways of celebrating spring. I want to bring on someone else now. This drama of springtime soil plays out in even the driest, most desolate places. And this year's El Nino rains delivered enough rain to Death Valley. This was really interesting, to produce what's known as a super bloom. And we sent our collaborator, Christian Baker, to check it out. Christian is an independent filmmaker and producer based in Los Angeles. Welcome back to Science Friday, Christian.
Hi, Ira. How's it going?
Tell us, first of all, what is this thing called the super bloom, and what does it look like?
It is awesome. Let me just say that. A super bloom is an above average bloom of desert wildflowers. It is in years of heavier precipitation in Death Valley. There is a rainfall will tap deep into the seed bank, this massive seed bank in the valley floor. And what results is what I can only describe as a field of dancing golden wonder. It's just beautiful. But I should also point out that superbloom is an unofficial term. So I personally would like to try and get that on the books as the official term. I think that would be great.
We'll start the meme superbloom or hashtag it. Yeah. Superbloom or something. Get it to,
exactly.
Get it to go viral. Why are the superblooms so rare? Is there a minimum amount of rainfall needed to kickstart one of these?
Yes. Well, Death Valley, on average, gets less than 3 inches of rain annually. But what happens is in years of heavier rain, especially years of heavier winter rain, that moisture will soak deeper into the soil. So if you picture, if you kind of picture beneath the soil, and we kind of get into this a little bit in the video, there's just this massive seed bank. Now, seeds might be an inch to 3 inches under the soil, under the surface of the soil, or they may be up to like 16 inches or even deeper. And in a year of average rainfall, moisture will only seep so far down into the soil. So in years of heavier rain, you get moisture that soaks obviously much deeper and can tap into these seeds that are buried deeper down. Now, to go a step further with that, if you want, I can talk about the coating on the seed.
Sure.
So these desert these seeds in the desert kind of come equipped with a natural insurance policy. So what you don't want is to get a little bit of rain and to start growing, because then there's not going to be enough moisture to support a full life cycle. Mm-hmm. But if you get a lot of rain, these seeds have this coating that sort of, it's a prohibitive coating. It prevents them from growing or sprouting too early. And if they get enough water, the water will actually erode the coating. And once this coating, which is sort of made of like a wax or a protein or could be even be like a natural chemical base, once that coating is eroded, then the seed can actually germinate. And presumably there's enough moisture available that it will support its full life cycle and allow it to, deposit more seeds for future blooms.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the video, Christian, you mentioned the video. It's up on our website at sciencefriday.com. And it's a gorgeous video. I mean, you can't do it. You know, going out there, I'm very jealous. You can go out there and get to see it. Let me just tell everybody, I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Noah, if there's a super bloom going on above the ground, is there a microbial version going on in the soil?
Oh, for sure. I mean, the name Death Valley would suggest, we think of it as being very inhospitable to life. But to microbes, they can do just fine in Death Valley, because a lot of them are tolerant of the conditions that the soils in Death Valley experience, and they can kind of stay dormant. They can stay dormant for days to weeks to months, even decades, and wait for those right conditions, that large rain event, for example, and really start growing in that short window of time when they can be active.
Hmm. There was an article out this week by Jim Robbins in Yale Environment 360 in which he writes about the uncertainty facing the world's microbes as the climate changes. Is that a concern of yours, Noah?
Oh, for sure. I mean, we know the soil microorganisms do a lot of important things for us, from growing crops to cycling carbon in natural ecosystems. What remains to be determined is how are they going to respond to climate change? We're starting to get a handle on how plants and animals may respond to climate change. But when it comes to understanding how those soil microbes are going to respond to climate change and how that may impact our ecosystems, it's a big unknown, and we're really just starting to figure that out.
Mm-hmm. Christian, what's the future of the super bloom? Do you think you'll see another one in your lifetime?
That is definitely the hope. I do know that... The issue of the drought in Southern California, we're in the midst of a 4-year-long drought, that could be impacting future super blooms. However, I've gotten mixed answers from the various people that I've spoken to, various botanists and park rangers and whatnot. So On the one hand, people are very optimistic that we will see another superbloom. It just could take a few years. It could take a few decades.
Is it over? Is it too late for us to get on a plane and get out there and see it?
Unfortunately, they were hoping for greater rains in the last few weeks. Earlier this month, I think, there were supposed to be some storms that were going to pass through Death Valley. Unfortunately, that did not happen. That would have kind of kick-started another wave of bloomage, if you want to put it that way. Yeah. But the rains did not come. However, I did just see, I checked the website right before we got on the radio, and I do believe there's some cactus blooming now. So
that's gorgeous.
There's always
stuff.
A little bit of life out there.
Yeah, that is, cactus bloom is gorgeous stuff. And it's the desert always blooms earlier than everything else for some reason. What's going on there?
Well, it just depends on when that moisture is available. You know, obviously they have plenty of sunlight in the desert, at least most times. It's just waiting for that pulse of moisture to enter the soil, and everything really springs into action. All the microbes, the plants, the whole soil food web really starts ramping up.
Well, Christian, it's a great video. It's up there on our website at sciencefriday.com. Thank you for taking such beautiful pictures.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And bringing it home as much as anyone can. I'm sure trying to capture that giant scope of many miles of flowers blooming. And Noah, have you ever seen one? Super bloom?
I have, actually. It was in, I believe, around 2000, 2001. It was very impressive.
15 years between blooms is a while. It's worth waiting for. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you,
Ira. Thank you, Ira.
You're welcome. Noah Fear is a microbial ecologist, associate professor at the University of Colorado in Boulder. Christian Baker, and an independent filmmaker and a producer based out in L.A. And if you want to see the super bloom, you can check out his video on our homepage at sciencefriday.com. B.J. Lederman composed our theme music, and our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. And on the web, have you ever tried to throw air? Yeah, give it. Write that. No, that's not going to work. We've got instructions for making an air-launching device called a vortex cannon. And yes, we cover the physics of how it works, too. You can find it at sciencefriday.com/vortexcannon. Maybe a great project for your classroom. Don't do it in anyone's ear. I've seen that happen, but handle it safely, as everything else. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.